Lecture 3, Second Century and Self-Definition.
We have seen that Christianity was not born out of a carefully developed program by Jesus of Nazareth, but by the conviction that this executed criminal was the resurrected Lord and the life-giving Spirit among his followers. In our last lecture, we caught a glimpse of earliest Christianity in its first years, how it moved across the Roman Empire from Jerusalem to Rome, establishing dozens of small communities, managing five major transitions as it did from the beginning, writing letters, engaging in certain shared practices, experiencing persecution from without, and divisions already from within. In this lecture, I want to look at our next identifiable historical moment, namely the second century, because it is in the second century I want to show that Christianity really defined itself as a new and distinct religion, rather than as a sect of Judaism. In the beginning of the second century of the Common Era, Christianity had become an identifiable presence in the Roman Empire, whose development was natural and organic, but was also bore the marks of its first creative expansion. The most obvious thing that strikes us when we look at Christianity in the early years of the second century is the dominance of Gentile Christianity over Jewish Christianity, and of Greco-Roman culture on Christianity. From the beginning, Christianity had been much more successful at drawing Gentiles into its ranks than Jews. And there was an increased difficulty in appealing to fellow Jews. For example, around the year 57, Paul, in his letter to the Romans, in chapters 9 to 11, engages in a long argument in which he hopes for and expects the conversion of his fellow Jews even during his lifetime. But 30 years later, in the Acts of the Apostles, Luke looks back on the Jewish mission as pretty much over. The final words of his hero, Paul, in the Acts of the Apostles is, "This word of salvation has been sent to the Gentiles, they will believe." So there's a combination of rejection by Christians' fellow Jews and acceptance by Gentiles. Indeed, it can be argued that one of the reasons for Christianity's rapid expansion and success is that it rode on the back of Judaism. It offered to Gentiles a more accessible and less arduous form of Judaism, not requiring circumcision and the observance of the law. It was popular among Gentiles, but not among Jews. For Jews, Jesus was a failed, possibly a false Messiah, cursed by God because of the means of his death. Furthermore, Christians were not loyal to Judaism. In the Jewish war against Rome in the year 67 to 70, the small Christian community in Jerusalem departed, left the city before the final and climactic battle that led to the burning of the city and the destruction of the temple. And there was also rejection from the Jewish side. Sometime around the year 85, Jewish synagogues developed what is called the 19th benediction, or the Birkat Haminim, the benediction against heretics, in which it forbade those who proclaimed two powers in heaven to be part of their worship. So in effect, Christians were excluded from the synagogue as well. So sociologically and symbolically, in the early second century, Christian churches resembled Greco-Roman schools, philosophical schools, which, as you remember, were well organized and followed a common way of life and teachings and so forth than they did the Jewish synagogue. Their structure, organizational structure, resembled that of Greco-Roman clubs and schools. And the major impact from the synagogue was in the forms of worship in early Christianity. The reading of Torah, the reading of Scripture, the prayers, the use of psalms and hymns, these all came not from the side of Greco-Roman culture, but from the side of Jewish culture. As communities, Christian communities, began to exchange and collect their writings, and this was an important step toward Christianity becoming a common thing, that is, that churches that received a letter from Paul exchanged them with other communities and got their letters, sort of the way we traded comic books when we were kids, so that you formed a collection of texts that gave you a kind of a common library. And this began really right after the death of Paul. As they began to collect and exchange their writings, the question of how do we relate ourselves to Judaism was both pressing and pretty much predetermined. Christianity was going away from Judaism. Indeed, it is in Justin's Dialogue with Trypho, written around the year 135, that we find our last serious face-to-face exchange between a Christian and a Jew on a fairly equal basis. The year 135 is significant because this was when Jerusalem was finally destroyed by the Romans following the Bar Kokhba revolt. And Trypho, the Jewish leader, encountered Justin, and they had a several-day conversation in which, revealingly, the topics revolved mainly around which version of Scripture is better, the Hebrew Bible or the Greek translation. Trypho says the Hebrew version. Justin says the Greek translation. And secondly, and very much connected with that, how do the prophecies of the prophets, are they fulfilled in Jesus or not? And obviously, Trypho and Justin disagree about that as well. But that is really the last gasp of a face-to-face encounter between Christianity and Judaism for a long time. And Christianity becomes more and more Gentile. The sparse literature of the second century, the early second century, reveals a movement that was diverse and sometimes divided, concerned for moral teaching and practice rather than theological speculation, and eager to offer a defense against attackers. We see the emergence of bishops. The term bishop, episkopos, means a superintendent. And we see strong leaders like Ignatius of Antioch and Polycarp of Smyrna who emerge as intellectual and moral leaders of communities. Ignatius of Antioch wrote 7 letters as he was being transported on his way to Rome to be executed, wrote letters to 7 different churches across Asia Minor, instructing them in how they should live. Polycarp also collected the letters of Ignatius and then added a further letter of his own in which basically he pulled together the teachings of Ignatius and Paul and communicated them to the church in Philippi. These intellectual and moral leaders, these bishops, represented a kind of an institutional Christianity. But the voice of prophecy was not yet entirely dead. The Shepherd of Hermas was written in the city of Rome, in which a simple layperson received visions from God and challenged the wealthy and called them to a life of poverty. And the early writing called the Teaching of the 12 Apostles, the Didache, gives instructions on how visiting prophets are to be received by communities. So there still was some sense of itinerant prophetic activity in the church in the early second century. But more and more, Christianity appeared as an organization that was given to a kind of a domestication, moral teaching, and so forth. Not a concern for doctrine or theology so much as good behavior. So Polycarp's letter to the Philippians weaves together those passages from the Apostle Paul that deal not with theology, but with how people are to live in the household and how they are to live in the assembly, how they are to take care of widows, and so forth. And Clement of Rome, writing around the year 95 to the church in Corinth, a church to which Paul himself had written, takes up the theme of harmony and unity and good behavior in the assembly in opposition to movements of rivalry and envy which were causing dissension in that community. Christianity, if you will, was very moralistic. in the beginning of this second century. It was also a dangerous profession. There were sporadic and increasing persecutions of the Christian movement as it became more popular, as it gained more adherence, beginning with a very small touch with Nero in the year 64. There were subsequent persecutions under the emperors Domitian, Trajan, and Marcus Aurelius in the second century. And this meant that martyrdom, bearing witness even to death, being executed by the Roman authorities, was not infrequent among these early Christians. Both Ignatius and Polycarp were martyrs. Persecution also stimulated the development of apologetic literature written by Christians in the early second century. The word apologetic comes from the Greek word apologia, which means a defense. And apologetic literature is fascinating because it is the effort by a group that is countercultural to explain itself to the larger culture, but in order to do that, it must use the terms of the larger culture. And so even as it's showing how we're just like you, it also functions as a means of self-definition, but because by portraying ourselves in the language of others, we also become assimilated to the language of others. So we have a lovely composition called The Letter of Diognetus. We don't even know who Diognetus was, but it was written around the middle of the century to the emperor Antoninus Pius, who probably never read it. But it portrays Christians as in remarkable fashion as being just like everybody else in the world. He says we don't dress differently, we don't act differently, we don't eat strange foods, but we are the soul of the world. An image which says that Christians are, in some sense, the life-giving ferment of society. And we have the apology written by Justin, the same person who entered into disputation with Trypho the Jew, in which he portrays Christianity as a philosophical school, in terms that would be intelligible to the wider Greco-Roman culture. Now, all of this was happening in the first half of the second century. It is the second half of the second century that generated forms of diversity within the Christian movement that challenged it in fundamental ways and demanded a more explicit form of self-definition. There was in the second century a strong tendency toward cosmic dualism and religious asceticism in a variety of forms. Cosmic dualism. Cosmic dualism is a view of reality in which two powers are pretty much on an equal plane and competing with each other. Good and evil. And in the second century, good was pretty much lined up with spirit, and evil was pretty much lined up with physical reality or materiality. Asceticism means discipline. It comes from the Greek word ascesis, which means simply discipline. Asceticism then means self-control, especially in sexual matters and in dietary matters. When asceticism is connected to cosmic dualism, it obviously implies that by controlling physical reality, one cultivates the spirit and diminishes the impact of the physical. Now, this broad movement of asceticism and cosmic dualism was not unique to Christianity in the second century. It appears in Greco-Roman literature, in the Hermetic literature. It appears in Jewish literature, in early mystical texts, such as the Hekhalot literature. But it is in Christianity that its influence is most impressive and almost redefines this movement. Now, it is not entirely heterodox or heretical in character. We find traces of this cosmic dualism and this asceticism in popular Christian writings, which otherwise do not challenge the common convictions in any fundamental way, and were eagerly read by Christians as part of their recreational literature, if you will. Let me give you two examples. One is the Infancy Gospel of James, which is written around the year 150 and is remarkable for its attention to the mother of Jesus, Mary. It is this gospel that places a particular importance upon Mary's biological virginity. Even after the birth of Jesus, clearly there is a kind of an obsession with virginity as opposed to active sexuality. The infancy gospel of James, by the way, is where we get the tradition that Joseph was an old man. That's how Joseph is portrayed. That Mary was a young girl who was Joseph's ward. That they weren't really married in any real sense of the term. And it was this apocryphal writing which really became the source for much of Christian iconography through the ages. It's not from the canonical gospels, but from the infancy gospel of James. Another writing is the Acts of Paul and Thecla. Again, in this writing, this writing is dated around the year 180, Paul is portrayed as identifying the resurrection with a life of virginity. And Thecla, the heroine, abandons her fiancé to join Paul in a virginal way of life. And they practice severe physical asceticism together with a life of virginity. So all of these writings were part of the Christian collection. It is when we turn to the blanket term Gnosticism, which covers a wide range of Christian ascetical and dualistic tendencies, which are connected to peculiar convictions concerning a revealed, esoteric, secret, saving knowledge that applies only to some people and not others, that we find the powerful challenge to Christianity as a religious movement. Now, one form of this dualism moved in the direction of contracting traditional texts and tenets. The Assyrian teacher Tatian, for example, who wrote a powerful apology called Against the Greeks, in which he chastised the Greeks for their polytheism and their immoral way of life, was equally scandalized by the fact that there were four Christian Gospels. He thought that that plurality didn't make sense. And so he wanted to create a single gospel harmony. And so he wrote a book called the Diatessaron, which in Greek means through the four. And he wove together the four Gospels into a single life of Jesus. He also advocated a form of Christianity in which everybody had to be a virgin in order to be a Christian. Even more influential was a teacher called Marcion, who around the year 150 was a failed candidate for the bishopric of Rome, and in a high dudgeon went off and formed his own form of Christianity, which was profoundly dualistic. For Marcion, the world is equally divided between good and evil, and evil is all lined up on the side of physical reality, and good is all lined up on the side of spirit. Now, the implication of this is that the creator God of the Old Testament, the God of the Jews, is an evil God because he created materiality. Jesus, for Marcion, was a liberator from the body. Therefore, there has to be an absolute division between Jesus and his followers and Judaism. So it is Marcion in his book Antitheses who develops a stereotype which many Christians have never lost. That is, the evil God of justice, the angry God of the Old Testament, over against the loving God represented by Jesus, who has nothing to do with Judaism. So logically then, Marcion advocated a reduction of the Christian canon, that it would consist only in the 10 letters of Paul. Paul's the only one who got Jesus right, for Marcion, and then an expurgated version of the Gospel of Luke, which Marcion thought Paul meant when Paul said, my gospel. So we have only some of Paul's letters, 10, and only one gospel, and Marcion therefore thought that Christianity could have only one theological position. And that one position was, to be a Christian, you need to be a virgin, you need to be ascetical, you need to flee the world of materiality, and that to be a Christian meant that you had to be a person of the spirit and not of the body. Tatian and Marcion move in the direction of reduction. Simultaneously, And this is why the crisis was so complex. Simultaneously, the movement of Gnosticism expanded the sources of authority within Christianity. Now, our knowledge of Gnosticism derives mainly from the writings of Christians against the Gnostic teachers, writers such as Irenaeus and Tertullian, who give us long citations and descriptions of their teachings. And for a long time, that's all we had. But then in 1947, at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, we discovered an entire library of Gnostic writings, a bizarre collection of gospels, revelatory texts, tractates. Some of them clearly have no connection with Christianity, some of them deeply hostile to Judaism, and some not so hostile to Judaism. But from both these outsider sources and insider sources, we have a better view now of how powerful this movement really was. Both the Cephean and Valentinian forms of Gnosticism. Cephean Gnosticism is explicitly hostile to Judaism, explicitly hostile to the Creator God. Valentinian Gnosticism, slightly less hostile toward Judaism. But both of them challenged traditional Christian teaching in favor of a continuing revelation that is contained in inspired writings, and contain an ascetic ideology. So Gnostics divided the humanity into three categories. The Gnostics, the pneumatikoi, who were the elite and who alone would be saved. The psychic, who had possibilities if they could be converted to Gnosticism. And the hylic, the mud people, who had no future at all. And in their view, the people who went to the ordinary Christian churches were largely the hylic. They had a few psychic among them from whom they could get to their followers. But Gnosticism fundamentally is a highly individualistic, highly mystical, highly elitist form of Christianity. It proposes new teachings, new teachers, and new scriptures that encompass the traditional teachings, but reinterpret them in a fundamental way, so that Christianity becomes a matter of only the smart get saved, to put it in really simple terms. That in order to be a true believer, one had to practice, the practices of Christianity were not those of the body, but rather those that fled the body, so that severe asceticism was required, both sexually and in diet. Indeed, anorexia is sort of the body language of Gnosticism. The less you have of the body, the more you have of the spirit. This was a powerful challenge. There were times in the second century when the followers of Tatian, of Marcion, and of Valentinus probably numerically outnumbered those of the party we now call the Orthodox, those who were the mud people, if you will. But it was such a challenge because it was not simply a matter of new teachers and new texts, but it was a fundamental ideological challenge which moved Christianity from being a public and embodied tradition to one that was esoteric, mystical, and individualistic. Now, the response of the teachers we now call Orthodox, this is obviously a biased description, right thinking or right teaching teachers, the response of teachers like Tertullian and Irenaeus and Clement of Alexandria had profound consequences for the shape of Christianity through the centuries. Tertullian was in North Africa. Clement of Alexandria was in the city of Alexandria in Egypt. Irenaeus was a bishop of Lyon in France. They wrote massive works in rebuttal of this Gnostic tendency. And the volume of their writings indicates to us how important literacy was among these Christians, how much intellectual labor was going into all of these things, despite the fact that there was still martyrdom going on, still persecution going on. There was lively intellectual debate. Irenaeus, in particular, in his book Against Heresies, Book 3, developed a well-balanced response to the Gnostic challenge. Rather than a truncated or expanded collection of writings, Irenaeus took his stand on a canon of scripture that included the Old Testament, all the Old Testament writings, and the 27 writings of the New Testament. Not because these writings were inspired, but because they represented the sense of what the church really was. Notice that Christianity, therefore, set itself in a position of a continuing dialogue with Judaism. Christians did not rewrite the Old Testament in the way that the Quran does, or retell that story. Rather, the Christian writings form an appendix to the Old Testament. The second element of Irenaeus' strategy was to oppose this wide variety of myths that were developed by the Gnostics with what was called a rule of faith, a set of propositions which functioned to guide the reading of Scripture. This is what later became the creed, that is, the profession of faith, which states how Christians see reality. So that even the most adventuresome theologian in the Orthodox party, Origen of Alexandria in the late second and early third century, began his adventure in speculative theology by recounting those teachings that he shared in common with all other Christians before entering into his systematic theology. Thirdly, and very significantly, Irenaeus proposed the apostolic succession as opposed to the secret teachers, so that we have now a canon rather than expanded writings, we have a rule of faith rather than myths, and we have a tradition of teachers. Now, Irenaeus demonstrated this apostolic succession by tracing the bishops of Rome back from his own time to Saint Peter. And in so doing, he shows us the importance of the Roman Church already in the late second century. It was regarded by Irenaeus as others as the most important of the churches. Now, Irenaeus' strategy of self-definition that he used in the battle with Gnosticism became standard for later internal conflicts within Christianity. Whenever there would be a crisis within Christianity, bishops, the apostolic succession, these public institutional figures, would gather in council, read the scriptures, the canon of scriptures, and on that basis, elaborate the creed, elaborate the rule of faith. And this is the way that Christians responded to subsequent crises. So at the beginning of the third century, Christianity was internally prepared for its long period of political and cultural influence that began with Constantine in 313 CE, the year when Constantine issued the Edict of Milan, which changed Christianity from being a persecuted minority to being the official religion of the Roman Empire. This process of self-definition was not simply conceptual. The church that emerged out of the debate with Gnosticism was embodied. Christianity really values the body. Christianity notoriously has had problems with sex. And in what to do with sexuality. But it has always affirmed the importance of marriage and the importance of having children. And at that level, at least, it countered the view of Gnosticism, which thought of sexuality as collaboration and evil and having children as the perpetuation of evil materiality. So Christianity has remained embodied. It has remained public. It includes potentially all people, not just the smart, not just the elite. Hoi polloi belong to the Christian movement. It is institutional in character. That is, it has visible leaders rather than secret and charismatic gurus. And these official leaders may not be terribly bright themselves, but nevertheless, they are networked with each other in a form of organization. Finally, Christianity is ritual in character. Because bodies matter, the way bodies perform certain kinds of actions together is important. Space and time matter because bodies matter. This communion among Orthodox bishops, finally, made them the visible leaders within the empire in this community. So that when Constantine makes Christianity the official religion of the empire, It is these orthodox leaders, not the secret teachers, who are going to be an important body of people to interact with. And we find then, in subsequent centuries, the fact that orthodox Christianity tends to be imperial Christianity, and that heterodox forms of Christianity tend to flourish outside the boundaries of the Roman Empire, in East Syria, in Egypt, and in North Africa. At the end of the second century, Christianity is internally prepared to take on the burden of being the imperial religion.